Hello and welcome to Patriotic History. Today's date is Friday the 20th of January 2023 and you're listening to me, Sam Longshanks, streaming at radioalbion.com. This is a series where we look at white contributions to civilization, the earliest evidence that we have of the white race throughout the world, and we started in the Fertile Crescent. We worked our way through Egypt, we worked our way through Mesopotamia until we got to Britain. We looked at the early British history, the prehistoric history, and we looked at the Roman period. We took us up to the Saxons and the wars between the Cymry and the Saxons, and we just finished looking at Charles Martel, and now we're going to move back to Britain and talk some more about the golden period of the Saxons. And of course, I have two co-hosts with me. I have Truthvids from truthvids.net, and I have the Patriarch from the Patriotic Arts Community. Truthvids, hello, sir. How are you doing?
Hello, Sven. Been looking forward to Alfred the Great. I think he's a source of inspiration. He was a great king, someone who at some point in his life was down in the dumps, right? He lost his kingdom, was literally living in a swamp, but managed to keep his faith in God and reclaim the kingdom. And thanks to him, we had this great Christian civilization that really kicked off from then on, right, over England.
He's an absolutely amazing king and a complete inspiration. I think one of the first podcasts I actually did was talking about Alfred the Great, so I'm very pleased to be revisiting him now. Patriarch, how are you doing? Welcome back to the show. How's life treating you?
Hey, Sven. Yeah, thanks for having me back. Yeah, life's good, thanks. So just looking forward to this episode. He's one of the more famous kings of ancient Britain, isn't he? So, yeah, I'll probably not have as much to add to this, but I'm keen to learn and kind of pick the brains of you and Truthvids.
Yeah, I mean, we could do dozens of episodes just on Alfred the Great. I mean, there is so much that he actually did during his life. But before we get on to that, we're just going to actually use a quote from Asser's Life of King Alfred. And Bishop Asser was the bishop that was asked by King Alfred to come down and help to teach his men and also to write down his life. And when he was writing the life about Asser, there are three sections talking about the daughter of King Offa. And we finished in the last episode talking a little bit about King Offa. So I thought what we should really do to begin off this episode is to continue with that. And the story is about why the West Saxons would not suffer to have a queen rule over them. For the nation of the West Saxons does not allow the queen to sit beside the king, nor to be called queen, but only the king's wife, which refusal, or rather reproach, the chief persons of that land say arose from a certain headstrong and malevolent queen of the nation, who did all things so contrary to her lord and to the whole people, that not only did the hatred which she brought upon herself bring to pass her exclusion from the queenly throne, but also entailed the same corruption upon those who came after her, since in consequence of the extreme malignity of that queen, all the inhabitants of the land banded themselves together by an oath, never in their lives to let any king reign over them who should bid his queen take her seat on the royal throne by his side. And because, as I think it is not known to many, whence this perverse and detestable custom first arose in Wessex, contrary to the custom of all the Germanic peoples, it seems to me right to explain it a little more fully, as I have heard it from my Lord Alfred, the truth-teller, king of the Anglo-Saxons, who often told me about it, as he also had heard it from many men of truth who related the fact, or I should rather say, expressly preserved, the remembrance of it. And I'll just stop there because I just want to point out that this shows you that when Asser was writing his history of Alfred the Great, he wasn't being forced to write positive things about Alfred, because this is a custom that the West Saxons had, and he's calling it perverse and detestable. So this shows us that this history that he wrote, this life that he wrote, he had totally free rein over what he was writing, because otherwise he wouldn't have been able to call this a perverse and detestable custom. And it also stayed the custom with the West Saxons. This is why there was a particular queen, the Lady of Mercia. She wasn't actually the queen, but she was queen in all but name. And they had to call her the Lady of Mercia. And she basically led the army. I forget now what her name was. It wasn't Edeburgh or something like that. We've actually covered her in our Greatest Britons because she was, although she wasn't actually known as the queen, she did take the place of the queen. And that was why she couldn't actually be called queen, is because of this custom. So it's interesting that Asser refers to it as a detestable custom here. And I'll just get into what he has to say about why they had this custom. There was in Mercia in recent times a certain valiant king who was dreaded by all the neighbouring kings and states. His name was Offa, and it was he who had the great dike made from sea to sea between Wales and Mercia. His daughter, named Edeber, who was married to Beortric, king of the West Saxons. The moment she had possessed herself of the king's goodwill and practically the whole power of the realm, she began to live tyrannically after the manner of her father. Every man whom Beortric loved, she would execrate, and would do all things hateful to God and man, accusing to the king all whom she could, thus depriving them insidiously either of life or of power. And if she could not obtain the king's consent, she used to take them off by poison, as is ascertained to have been the case with a certain young man beloved by the king, whom she poisoned, seeing that she could not accuse him to the king. It is said, moreover, that King Beortric unwittingly tasted of the poison, though the queen had intended to give it not to him, but to the young man. The king, however, was beforehand with him, and so both perished. And again, I will stop there, because this shows you that Asser was not very kindly predisposed to Offa. And as you remember in the last episode, the Welsh had this battle with Offa because Offa tried to move the dike forward 4 miles into the kingdom of Powys. So Asser is not particularly well impressed with Offa. So this is why he says that he was a tyrant. And again, this shows you that he wasn't being censored in what he was writing in his life of Alfred here. I guess I should also stop here rather than continuing with this whole piece. We've got another section to go yet, and I'll just get your thoughts on this. What do you make of this so far, Truthvids?
Yeah, that woman you was talking about, I looked up, I forgot her name as well. It's Ethelfled, that they're all F or this, F or that, right? But that was actually Alfred's daughter. So at this point, where we're talking, Mercia was kind of the dominant force. I believe even Charlemagne considered, marrying a daughter of Mercia, because he saw Mercia as a formidable force. But then Ragnarok Lodbrok, one of the Danish Swedish kings, came over. And just after this, the king of Mercia ended up capturing him and executing him. And that caused the great heathen army, which was led by the sons of Ragnar, came over. And Mercia lost like half their kingdom to the Danes. And that's when the power started to shift over to Wessex, and that's when we get to Alfred, which is a little bit later. So back to this queen. Basically, Offa had put like a puppet king on the king of Wessex, that's Beorfric, if I'm pronouncing it right, and he'd married his daughter to that king. So basically, he had power over that king, and because Beorfric owed his kingdom to the father of his wife, the wife had enormous influence. He couldn't do anything. You know, when you're in that position, he can't exactly, shout at his wife, because her father's basically given him all the power. And obviously the power went to her head, and that's what caused, this great disgust of her, right? That's how I would see it anyways.
Well, that's great. I mean, that really fleshes this out. And I'm also reminded of Queen Albion, or Princess Albion, and her sisters. And they married all these kings that her father had told them that they should marry. Yet because none of these kings were up to the same level as Princess Albion's father, they all rebelled against their lords, and they ended up slitting their throats. If people want to check out that, where we get the name Albion from, it actually goes back to Princess Albion, and we did a whole episode on it. So it's a similar story there of these princesses just being so badly behaved. They decided here, well, we can't actually have one of these on the throne again, just in case it happens again. Patriarch, any thoughts on this?
Yeah, she seemed to be quite, well, a lot of female leaders seem to be quite ruthless, don't they? And I think that that kind of, you see that in even today, in modern day, a lot of women, when they get to a height of power, they seem to be kind of straight-nosed and sometimes more merciless than men, you know? So I think they, you know, had their reservations about it, but perhaps, I don't know, how much previous experience did they have with female queens and leaders prior to her? Or was it just a real bad experience that put them off?
You know, I can't recall actually hearing of any. I mean, we heard of Boadicea. I mean, Boadicea was quite a heroine. So it's not that like they're just only recording the badly behaved ones. We did have Boadicea. And as Truth was saying after this, we had Æthelflæd. And she was the Lady of Mercia that I was referring to there. So we do have some that were good. And obviously we've had some that were bad. And this is where this custom came from with the Wessex kings, that they couldn't have a queen on the throne. Well, after this happened, after Edeber had basically assassinated her own husband, Edeber's further life, King Beortric, therefore being dead, the queen, since she could no longer remain among the Saxons after that, sailed beyond the sea with countless treasures and came to Charles, King of the Franks, and that's obviously Charlemagne. As she stood before the throne, bringing many gifts to the king, Charles said to her, "Choose, Edeber, between me and my son, who stands with me on this dais." And that's because somebody would have had to marry her. And that's why she was there. She was there so that somebody else could take the place of the king that she was married to. So he's saying, "Choose between me or my son." She, without deliberation, foolishly replied, "If I am to have my choice, I choose your son, because he is younger than you." At which point Charlemagne smiled and answered, "If you had chosen me, you should have had my son. But since you have chosen him, you shall have neither me nor him." However, he gave her a large convent of nuns, in which, having laid aside her secular habit and assumed the dress worn by the nuns, she discharged the office of abbess for a few years. As she is said to have lived irrationally in her own country, so she appears to have acted much more so among a foreign people, for being finally caught in illicit intercourse with a man of her own nation, she was expelled from the monastery by the order of King Charlemagne. Henceforward, she lived a life of shame in poverty and misery until her death, so that at last, accompanied only by one slave, as I have heard from many who saw her, she begged her bread daily at Pavia, and so wretchedly died. So even when she was a beggar, she still had one slave left to her. And I think this also shows us that this idea of romance and falling in love with someone and marrying them, that isn't what happened in the past. I mean, she had to marry one of this royalty. It was an arranged marriage, and she should have said she would marry the king, Charlemagne, and then he would have given her the younger son anyway. But it was because she didn't pay the respect and say, "Well, I will marry you." That's why this happened. So that's the moral of this story. Truefids, any comments on this?
Yeah, I think she should have just said that, you know, "I'll marry whoever you want. I'm in no position. I've got no leverage. Just please have mercy on me, and I'll marry any lord or whoever you want." And Charles would have probably had sympathy on her, and perhaps he would have married his son to him, right? To her, rather, sorry. But yeah, and I just want to point it out that looking at the name Beorfric, so Egbert, who we're going to get into, he was actually the next in line for the king, but he was kicked out by the Mercian king and Beorfric was put in place. So Egbert was actually living in France under Charlemagne, and here he probably spent, there's a dispute whether it was 3 years or 13 years, but he must have learned all the governing, you know, the governmentship from Charlemagne, obviously, who had a great, vast Christian kingdom, and seen what a Christian kingdom can really achieve. And so when he went back, he of course was Christian as well, right?
Well, that must have been where Alfred got the respect that he paid for Charlemagne from, because he certainly saw Charlemagne as a great hero. Well, that must have been where it actually came from his grandfather, whatever relation it was, that was actually at the court of Charlemagne at the time. And yeah, that's what Edobert should have said. Oh, I will marry whoever you tell me to marry, my lord. That would have been the correct thing to say, of course. But yeah, so she thought she could choose who she wanted to marry, which again shows us that it was all arranged marriages back then. And I don't think that was just for royalty. I know that was for the aristocratic class, but it may well have been for the other classes as well that we had in society, or castes that we had in society back then. Patriarch, any thoughts on this?
Yeah, I was just going to make a point of it, alluded to the caste system that they had, and also the, you know, to retain wealth and power, wasn't it? So that was still very much in play there. But she clearly saw herself as a ruler and had little respect for the other men. And I guess she just fell, kind of got humbled, didn't she, towards the end?
Yeah, we can also see that royalty ended up being put in charge of nuns or being put in charge of a monastery back then. You know, if the king would have a certain number of sons, one of them would always be given to the church. Or daughters, and they would be given to the church, like it is here, and that's why Charlemagne did that, and gave her this convent of nuns. We'll see later on that Alfred creates monasteries as well, and puts people in charge of them. Well, moving back to R.W. Morgan's History of the Britons, and it's referring here to the events that we were talking about last week. Conan left the throne in A.D. 817 to his sole daughter, Isolde, or Isola, and through her to her husband Mervyn, the King of the Isle of Man, Prince of Powys, and Count of Chester. And again, this is the kings of the Britons being referred to here. The rest of the kingdom south of the Tweed in AD 820 now began to be called Angleland, or England, whether from the Angles, thus ignoring the existence of the Saxons, or from some other cause, is not clear. The fusion of the various tribes within it ceasing to be known as Saxon, they all took the common designation among themselves of English. The Cymry, however, with characteristic pertinacity, persist in retaining the name Logri and Sasson for them. And if you head into England from Wales, you'll see that it refers to Logris on the bridge there rather than as England. Egbert of West Saxony was crowned in AD 824 as Bratwalder, or the Wielder of Britain, a dignity intended to represent the British Pendragonate at Winchester. He defeated Mervyn at Llanfaes in Anglesey in 825, and in 835 wrested from him Chester, making it henceforth an English city. He destroyed all the old British monuments and statues, and made it death for a Cymry to be found on the east of the Dee. Mervyn fell in battle in AD 843 at Kettle against Bertred of Mercia, and he was succeeded by his son Rhodri Mawr. Rhodri changed the seat of government from Caernarvon to Aberfraw. He fell in AD 847, like his predecessor in battle on the Menai against the Danes, who were now pouring their forces in on every part of the British coasts. Anaret, his son, succeeded him. Egbert had settled Angle colonies in the country between Chester and Conwy, hence called the Tegangle. These were now exterminated by Anarud and Hobart, prince of the Strathclyde Britons in the north, and the land occupied by them bestowed by Anarud on the latter. Edred, Duke of Mercia, leaguing with the Danes, attempted to wipe out this disgrace by invading Vinedotia, but was utterly defeated by Anarud, and with the loss of 15,000 men in the Battle of Dialmodri, or Rodri's Revenge, at Cynwyd near Conwy. After the victory, Anarud carried his arms into England as far as Warwick, returning with immense booty. In England, Egbert the Bratwalder had been succeeded by Ethelwulf, Ethelwulf by Ethelbald, Ethelbald by Ethelbert, and Ethelbert by Ethelred, who was finally succeeded in AD 871 by Alfred. The prime minister and biographer of Alfred was Asa, or Geraint Vergids, the bishop of St. Asaph, and Alfred died in AD 901. So that gives us the Welsh version of the history there, taking us from 817 all the way up to 901, And we're going to stay around about 8:50 to 8:70, talking about Alfred for quite some time now, I should imagine. But first off, I'll offer it back up to Treefiz. Do you want to pick up on any of these points that we were just talking about there?
Yeah, it's interesting that the country got called after the Angles, not the Saxons, right? But there seems to have been a special relationship between the two tribes, the Angles and Saxons. They never really considered, there wasn't really animosity between the two, right? They kind of just fused together. And if you look biblically, the two tribes, that there's, you know, evidence that England was Ephraim, and large parts of America were settled by parts of England, and that would be Manasseh. So you have those two tribes who have this special relationship, right? And are more close than all the other tribes in Europe. So it would make sense because they were the two sons of Joseph. And as we said before, Angle probably comes from the Hebrew word the bull. So, you know, the bull land or the tribe of the bull. So it was part of prophecy that we would end up with that name, right? And I just wanted to say that where we get the line Alfred, you have Ecgberht, he had a son, Ethelwulf, and Ethelwulf, for some reason, he went to Rome for a period and left the throne to his son, Ethelbald. And then when he returned, Ethelbald refused to give up the throne. So they ended up splitting it between them, and then Ethelwulf died, and then 2 years later, Ethelbert died, and then it was passed to his brother, Ethelbert, and he reigned 6 years. Then he died, and then Ethelred reigned 6 years. That's the third brother. And then finally, Alfred got the throne. So he was like the least likely person, the fourth son. He probably never imagined that he would end up king, but he did eventually, right?
That's a bit like Bashar al-Assad, wasn't it? He studied to be an optician and an eye doctor, and it was supposed to be his brother that was taken over when the father died. But then the father died, and then the brother ended up dying as well. So he ended up becoming the president of Syria, and he really wasn't expecting that to happen. And the same here. Alfred was really not expecting that to happen. And I really like this term Bretwalda. The Britwalder, the wielder of Britain. I just think that's a fantastic term that they had. And it is just as good as Pendragon, I think, the Bratwalder. And it gives us an idea of the old Saxon language as well, because when the Normans came over, they added lots of Latin words to English. And whereas we had these great Saxon words before that, like lore, L-O-R-E. So astrology was star lore. And we still use this term today, L-O-R-E. It's a fantastic term to use. But yeah, I do like this term, Bretwalda. Any comments you want to make on this, Patriarch?
Another point about the Anglo-Saxons giving up the Saxon sort of heritage or name. And I think that could have been down to choosing the Angles over the Saxons was maybe down to their sort of past history of not being a sort of a fair game people, you know, because we've learned that they would often sort of slay priests that weren't armed and things like that. So maybe, you know, they had a more shady past, and they must have been fully amalgamated by this point anyway to not really have much affinity to, the Saxons, the Saxon heritage. And I guess just made sense to pander to the tribe with the, you know, more dominant kind of culture, I guess, and heritage.
Well, that's a really good point, isn't it? You know, the Saxons had a name for treachery, didn't they, with the Knight of the Long Knives. So, yeah, maybe it was better that they took the name the Angles and the English because of all these negative stories that have become associated with the word Saxon. Well, we're going to take our notes for Alfred the Great from Wikipedia, from Orthodox Wiki, and also from Asser's Life of Alfred. And we'll start with some quotes from Orthodox Wiki. The holy and right-believing King Alfred the Great was the King of Wessex from 871 to 899. He successfully stopped the advance of the Danes into Anglo-Saxon England, unifying the country. In addition to being the unifier of Anglo-Saxon England in the face of the Danish invasion, Alfred was a promoter of education, a father of English prose, a patron of the church, and a reviver of monasticism in the country. He is the only English monarch to be accorded the epithet the Great. And Alfred the Great is remembered on October 26th. And he's actually known as a saint in the Orthodox Church. He's actually Saint Alfred the Great. And it's rare that you actually get a king that fought in battles that is sainted. I don't think the Roman Catholic Church, I don't think they accept him as a saint, but they certainly do in the Orthodox Church. And that's why they're referring to him here as the holy and right believing king, Alfred the Great. And there's a moment in the life of Asa when he is baptizing Guthrum the Viking. And it tells you in the life of Alfred the Great that there was something called a chrism that was used. And afterwards, Guthrum stayed for a week with King Alfred, and King Alfred adopted him. And these are all customs that go back to the Orthodox Church rather than the Roman Catholic Church. So what you could really say is back then at this time, England was Anglo-Orthodox, which is really the correct term for it, rather than Roman Catholic. And it's the Orthodox Church that retains a lot about this history of Alfred the Great. In fact, Dr. Matthew Raphael Johnson did an Orthodox Nationalist on Alfred the Great probably about 12 years ago, 15 years ago, before he actually came to Radio Albion. It's on the Voice of Reason network, and people should be able to find that at theorthodoxnationalist.wordpress.com in the archive there. I think you did two episodes on Alfred the Great because he's such an important person to the Orthodox Church. Any thoughts on this, Treefids?
Well, yeah, and then there was the Great Schism. Was it in about 1100 AD, roughly? So basically,
1060, wasn't it? 1060. There was a schism, and the church split in two. And one side of the church became Roman Catholic, and the other side of the church became known as Eastern Orthodox. Basically, yeah, it was 1060 is the exact date, because I remember that because it was just 6 years before the Norman invasion. But yeah, please do continue, Truefitz.
Yeah. So basically, originally it was Justinian who. So that was a Byzantine emperor who gave the power and authority of the bishop. He was just a bishop in Rome and made him the pope, so the head bishop. And then gradually, centuries go on, the pope basically wants to wrestle away from being under the Byzantine emperor. And it was actually during Charlemagne's period that they switched to the West Roman and that became the West Roman Empire. So it was kind of a direct challenge to the Byzantines, who said, no, we're the Roman Empire. You know, you're just the Franks. Why are you calling yourself the Roman Empire? And he named Charlemagne the Emperor of the Romans. And then eventually this kept causing friction because now suddenly the Pope's over the Byzantine Empire. And then that's what caused the friction. And they had this falling out. Because the Byzantine empires were the ones who set up the Pope, and now the Pope's demanding authority over the Eastern Roman Empire, right?
Yeah, I mean that all fits in, doesn't it? Also, if I remember right from these early Orthodox Nationalist episodes, Britain wanted to settle an argument to do with the Bible or to do with the church or anything like that. They went to Jerusalem to have it settled rather than going to Rome, because they were the ones that were above them, were in the Eastern Roman Empire. So that's why there's this link with the Orthodox Church today. It's a stronger link with the Orthodox Church than it is to the Roman Catholic Church at this time. Patriarch, any thoughts about this?
No, just it's quite fascinating to think how he was the fourth in line, and then he ended up becoming one of the greatest kings we've ever had. I don't know if that throws into question the, the justification for the firstborn taking the helm or not, or whether it's just nature's way that the rightful, as defined by nature, kind of ended up with the throne. Don't know, but obviously we're better off for it.
Well, at this time also, the king would lead the army into battle, so there was more chance of a king actually losing his life. So I can imagine that it was important to have like a family of princes so that you had one there to replace the other one if you ended up being killed in battle. So they were quite lucky that he only actually left. And of course, then we can compare that to today with Prince Harry moaning and whinging about the fact that, you know, he's just a spare part. He's got your spare wheel. He's not needed for anything. Well, you can see that back then you did need to have as large a family as possible in case one of the princes became king, you know, he could end up dying in battle, which is what would often happen. Well, Alfred was born in 849 in the village Wanting, which is now Wantage in Oxfordshire, the youngest son of King Ethelwulf of Wessex and his first wife, Osburgha. Ethelwulf was a devout Christian, a trait that would reflect in Alfred's life. It was during his youth that Bishop Asser tells the story of how, as a child, Alfred won a prize of a volume of poetry in English offered by his mother to the first of her children able to memorise it. Legend also has it that the young Alfred spent time in Ireland seeking healing. He was troubled by health problems throughout his life, although today he is often portrayed as a great warrior who was noted more for his intellect. And we'll get into what those health problems were as we start getting into these quotes from Asser's Life of King Alfred, and we'll move into them now. And he talks about Alfred's rearing. He was extraordinarily beloved by both his father and mother, and indeed by all people beyond all his brothers. In inseparable companionship with them, he was reared at the royal court. As he advanced through the years of infancy and youth, he appeared more comely in person than his brothers, as in countenance, speech, and manners he was more pleasant than they. His noble birth and noble nature implanted in him from his cradle a love of wisdom above all things, even amidst all the occupations of this present life. But, with shame be it spoken, by the unworthy neglect of his parents and governors, he remained illiterate until he was 12 years old or more. Though by day and night he was an attentive listener to the Saxon poems, which he often heard recited, and being apt at learning, kept them in his memory. He was a zealous practiser of hunting in all its branches, and followed the chase with great assiduity and success. For his skill and good fortune in this art, and in all the other gifts of God, were beyond those of everyone else, as I have often witnessed. And again, I'll just stop there. I mean, it's quite incredible that he wasn't able to read until he was 12 years old, and yet he then ended up translating works from Latin into English, and he spearheaded this great movement of educating everyone in the kingdom, made certain that the judges learned to read and they were able to read. He set up a court school that wasn't just for the children of the nobles. It was for any child that showed an aptitude for this, because he wanted everybody to be educated. And he wasn't able to do any of this until after he defeated the Danes and come to a peace treaty with them. And he ended up inventing things like a special clock made out of a cow's horn, which you could put a candle inside, and that would prevent the wind from blowing the candle out, and he could work out that whatever line it was to would break up the day into hours. He would give instructions to all the artisans. I mean, it's very, very clear that he had this great aptitude for knowledge. But he was unable to read until he was 12 years old. Any thoughts about this, Truefitz?
Yeah, it just shows you that you're never too old to learn new skills. It's never like, you know, you want to learn new language. Well, you know, I should have done that in school. It's too late now. You can always focus your mind. And even if it's just an hour every night, you can, you know, learn all these new skills. And if you really focus your mind, you can do many things that you probably don't realize, right? And you can even learn suddenly, you know, at 40, 50 or older, how to web design or to set up a patriotic website or, you know, something like that. It's never too late to learn skills. And as for the Saxon language, it was probably very crude back then, not exactly the most poetic compared to Latin. It very likely was a Germanic type language. It was once the Norman invasion came, that's when we got a lot of French words and Latin came in, and it became more of a softer romantic language that it is now, right?
Yeah, and you're never too old to start learning things. And this was a great inspiration. There are so many inspirational things about Alfred's life. And of course, also remember, you know, Asser's not being censored in what he's saying here. He's, you know, if he had a criticism to make, he would have been perfectly fine to make it, because he's already made these criticisms of Saxon customs and of this Saxon king in Mercia. He's already made these criticisms. So you can say that what he has to say about King Alfred, you know, this is true. Maybe there's some embellishment. Maybe there's some little bits there to make him seem slightly better than he was. But he must have been, you know, quite incredible at all these things that Asser is talking about. Otherwise, he wouldn't have been able to write these. Because remember, this was contemporary. This was written at the time when King Alfred was still alive as well. So if there are any parts of it hadn't been true, there would have been records of that elsewhere. And there aren't any. I mean, this man was an absolute hero to the British people. Patriarch, any thoughts on these early points of his life and him being illiterate up until he was 12?
Yeah, I think it sounds worse than what it was. I mean, he's clearly a very competent talented, blessed individual. So I don't think it's the fact that he couldn't learn. It's just he was pursuing other thoughts and other things in his mind. You know, he was probably so creative that he probably spent his past times doing other things, and it probably wasn't until he got to an age where it was like, okay, you need to really learn this, that he probably took it upon himself. So yeah, I wouldn't say that he was literate due to kind of some defect on his half. I just think he probably put it off.
Well, he also trained his mind, I think, by remembering these poems. Because not everybody was literate, but what people did used to do is they used to remember poems off by heart. And I guess that it must have helped to remember them. If there'd been like rhyming parts to them, that would help to remember them. But they would remember whole sagas, they would remember off by heart. I think there's a legend about when the Septuagint was translated into Greek, and I think it was Alexander the Great. I think he got 60-odd scribes together to translate the from the Hebrew to the Greek, and they were just left alone to do that, and they could just remember it all by memory from the Hebrew, and then they translated it to the Greek, and they all got every part of it the same as each other, which is quite an incredible thing. But they used to remember so much by memory. Triffords, you might know more about that. The translation of the Septuagint and the link with memory. Are you acquainted with what I'm referring to there?
Yeah, Josephus says, but basically after Alexander, the whole East became Greek, right? The lingua de Franca, previously it had been not Assyrian, not Persian, but Aramaic. And that's not an Arabic language. It just means the Shemite language, right? Aram was the brother of Arphaxad and the other brothers where the Shemites descend from. And once Greek became the language, even in, you know, around Jerusalem, they thought, well, we've got to translate the Hebrew Bible to Greek because a lot of Israelites are starting to speak Greek. So they went down to Egypt, and the king there, Ptolemy, he was so impressed with, you know, the scriptures and all the tales that he wanted to be able to read it as well, because he thought it'd be a good idea to read all the laws, because if you're going to establish a kingdom, you need good laws. And he put a lot of the laws were based on the laws of the Bible. And when they came down, he was astonished that, as you said, they could recite virtually all the Bible just from memory. And when they were all put in separate rooms and it was all put together, it was all the same, and he couldn't believe it, right?
Yeah, it's quite an incredible story, but it just tells you about the great feats of memory that we used to have. I mean, even before we had mobile phones, everybody would just remember the contents of their phone book. They would remember all the phone numbers of everybody that they knew. And then we moved to mobile phones, and you're lucky if you remember your own phone number now, let alone everybody else's phone number, because we have devices that do that for us. So you can imagine that years and years ago, we had far, far, far greater memories than we actually have now. And that's the tradition that Alfred has here. He has this great memory. Moving on to Alfred and the Book of Saxon Poems. Now, on a certain day, his mother was showing him and his brothers a book of Saxon poetry, which she held in her hand. And finally, she said, "Whichever of you can soonest learn this volume, to him will I give it." Stimulated by these words, or rather by divine inspiration, and allured by the beautifully illuminated letter at the beginning of the volume, Alfred spoke before all his brothers, who, though his seniors in age, were not so in grace, and answered his mother, "Will you really give that book to that one of us who can first understand and repeat it to you?" At this, his mother smiled with satisfaction and confirmed what she had before said. "Yes," said she, "that I will." Upon this, the boy took the book out of her hand and went to his master and learned it by heart, whereupon he brought it back to his mother and recited it. So you see here that he had people that would read things out from books to him. And in actual fact, we learn later on that he was doing that all the time. He had people reading out from books to him all the time, which is, I guess, the equivalent of people being able to listen to podcasts today and listen to audiobooks. Back then, 1200 years ago, you had to have somebody standing there to do that. So, you know, you could only really do that if you were a king. And this actually reminds me of something. When I was a child, I had to remember a poem by Rudyard Kipling. It was the poem about what it means to be a man. And if I could recite the whole poem, I can remember I was given a watch for doing this. So it's rather a similar thing that's going on here with Alfred's mother. She's saying, if you can recite this poem back to me, this book back to me, then I will give the book to you. Any thoughts on this, Treefids?
Yeah, they didn't have like schools back then. There was nowhere where all kids go there. You know, back then, kids had to get working straight away and help out on the farm or whatever their father's profession was, you know, like blacksmith or whatever. They would be there helping their father, right? And the daughters, they would be learning how to sew and all that type of thing. Only, as you said, a lord or a king could have, you know, a priest. And, you know, back then, all the educated people were the churches and the monasteries. So that was the main, one of the main reasons why they were so necessary, because they could have the time to study scriptures and copy. I think, you know, to have a book, you'd have to have someone keep copying it to new parchment, to keep the books going, right? Because they would eventually get old and well, not rust, but they would just wither away, right? So yeah, you needed someone to stand next to you and constantly teach you. That was generally how the kids learned, you know, the royalty and the nobility. They could go wherever they were, they could always have someone constantly teaching them. And that's how they learned. And that's why people understood back then that only nobility could really rule or govern, because they were the only people who had a good education and knew all about the kingdom and the foreign kingdoms. And that's why only they were fit to really rule, right?
Yeah, and later on it tells you that there was nobody in the kingdom that could actually read. So it was only these masters that had been brought in, that were in the king's household, that knew how to do this. This is why Asser was brought into the kingdom, because he was a learned man. And this tells you that in Wales, they still had these monasteries, and they still had these scribes that were writing out these scrolls. But in England, there'd been all these battles with the Danes, and because of these battles with the Danes, Alfred hadn't been taught how to read up until he was 12 years old. It's quite incredible, really, what he achieved. Patriarch, any thoughts on this, learning by memory this book so that he could win it from his mother?
Yeah, well, I think it says not just a lot about Alfred, who took it upon himself to learn it, but it says a lot about his mother, the fact she regarded it as such a worthwhile book to memorize by heart. It's almost, you know, like a test to see which of her sons would be kind of diligent enough to take it upon themselves. And, you know, it'd be interesting to actually know what kind of poems are in the book as well. It could have really shaped Alfred's character growing up and helped him to become the man he became.
Yeah, it shows that his mother was you know, she understood the importance of the intellect. I mean, obviously they were boys. They'd have loved going out hunting. And maybe the others were more interested in the hunting. But Alfred was interested in the hunting and he was interested in the intellect. He wanted to remember this poem as well. And I guess this also brings in the amazing illuminated manuscripts, that they would write back then, like the Book of Kells, which you can see in Ireland there, where everything was very, very carefully written with sort of Gothic text with beautiful illustrations on them as well. And they would miniaturize all these things as well. So you can imagine that this book of poems, I mean, it tells us that it was beautifully illuminated as well. So they would literally take forever writing these things out, writing these books out, so that they looked absolutely amazing. You think they didn't have printing presses back then either. These monks would just be, you know, writing these scrolls out with their quills and illuminating them with paints, you know, day in, day out, and doing them, miniaturizing them as well. You know, because they're literally little tiny books that they would make, or tiny illustrations. They're quite incredible what they're able to do back then. Well, after this, he learned the daily course, that is the celebration of the hours. That's a religious thing. And afterwards, certain psalms and many prayers contained in a book which he kept day and night in his bosom, as I myself have seen and always carried about with him for the sake of prayer through all the bustle and business of this present life. But sad to relate, he could not gratify his ardent wish to acquire the liberal arts, because, as he was wont to say, there were at that time no good teachers in all the kingdom of the West Saxons. So he had a book there with psalms in it and prayers in it, and I guess he could get a religious man to read them out, or he would remember them. But what he really wanted, what he really wished for, was just to have an education. And what he's referring to is the liberal arts here. That was the trivium. I think it was rhetoric and philosophy, various other things that you needed to learn, that had been a part of civilization since the Greeks and with the Romans. And he knew about these things because he'd obviously seen these sort of things going on in Rome and heard about them in Charlemagne's court. But he was unable to get anything like that done in Britain at the time because of this war. And this is why he actually got Asser to come to the Kingdom of the West Saxons, was to help to actually teach his men and to bring education there. Perhaps, Truthford, you might know more about the liberal arts and what the education was like there that he's referring to. What do you make of this?
Yeah, well, first, I wasn't sure at what point I wanted to mention, but now's a good time, that Alfred actually went on a pilgrimage to Rome twice as a boy. So he must have been astonished seeing the city of Rome in all its splendor, you know, which was way, way more greater and more splendor than anything we had back then in England, probably, right? And he actually met the Pope as well. And of course, they would have all been speaking Latin and it would have been a foreign language. As for the Psalms, that there, a lot of the Psalms are about King David and his struggle, you know, about being under King Saul. And then when he was king, the struggle against the surrounding peoples and all the battles and his faith in God, right? I believe the arts would mostly be referring to that and you know, and any skills that that the monks and that had.
Yeah, and one of these things was with David, King David. King David was a great hero of Alfred's. I mean, that's one thing that really winds the pagans up when they talk about the Saxons. You say, well, their great hero is King David from the Old Testament, you know, and they'll get mad at you and they'll tell you that wasn't so. You know, here's the evidence of it. And also a lot of these Psalms or parts of the Psalter, Alfred actually ended up translating. Any thoughts on this, Patriarch?
Yeah, it's just quite amazing, really, to see what made him so great. You know, just kind of seeing, you know, what shaped him, and it, you know, obviously he's clearly rooted in, you know, he was basically stood on the shoulders of giants, didn't he? You know, so it's the first peoples, his ancestors, and learning from them, and just kind of goes to show the importance of what we need to do, and you know, not forget our ancestors and our heritage, and kind of retain them and cherish them and pass them on.
Yeah, he certainly wasn't given the epithet the Great for nothing. Well, Alfred's love of learning comes next. This he would confess, and that was the fact that there were no teachers, with many lamentations and with sighs from the bottom of his heart, to have been one of his greatest difficulties and impediments in this present life, that when he was young and had leisure and capacity for learning, he had no masters. But when he was more advanced in years, he was continually occupied, not to say harassed, day and night, by so many diseases unknown to all the physicians of this island, as well as by internal and external anxieties of sovereignty, and by invasions of the heathen, by sea and by land, that though he then had some store of teachers and writers, it was quite impossible for him to study. But yet, among the impediments of this present life, from childhood to the present day, and, as I believe, even until his death, he has continued to feel the same insatiable desire. So he's also talking there about illnesses, and he is well known for having illnesses. They think that he might have had Crohn's disease or some kind of irritable bowel syndrome. And there's actually an interesting story about this where he actually prays for piles. And this comes under a section called Alfred's Maladies. And it's actually talking about this while he's actually getting married. This is when Asa chooses to bring him this story. And it's basically he asked for piles to distract him from thoughts of lust, basically concupiscence, as the Roman Catholics referred to it as. He wanted something to take his mind away from all these passions and desires that he had when he was an adolescent. So he actually prayed that he would be given some kind of infirmity that wasn't able to be seen from the outside, so that he could struggle against that, and that would distract his mind from these thoughts of lust that he had. So Asa says here, while his nuptials were being honourably celebrated in Mercia among innumerable multitudes of both sexes, and after long feasts by night and by day, he was suddenly seized in the presence of all the people by instant and overwhelming pain unknown to any physician. No one there knew, nor even those who daily see him up to the present time, and this, sad to say, is the worst of all, whence such a malady arose. Many thought that it was occasioned by the favour and fascination of the people who surrounded him, others by some spite of the devil, who is ever jealous of good men, others from an unusual kind of fever, while others still thought it was due to the piles, because he had suffered this particular agonizing irritation even from his youth. So a different illness seized him when he was at his marriage, and then Asa goes on to explain how this instance of piles came to be. On a certain occasion, it had come to pass, by the divine will, that when Alfred had gone to Cornwall on a hunting expedition and had turned out of the road to pray in a certain church in Rest's St. Gerea, and now also St. Neot reposes there, he had of his own accord prostrated himself for a long time in silent prayer, since from childhood he had been a frequent visitor of holy places for prayer and the giving of alms, that's giving of money to poor people. And there he besought the mercy of the Lord, that in his boundless clemency, Almighty God would exchange the torments of the malady which then afflicted him for some other lighter disease, provided that such disease should not show itself outwardly in his body, lest he should be useless and despised, for he had great dread of leprosy or blindness, or any such complaint as instantly makes men useless and despised at its coming. When he had finished his praying, he proceeded on his journey, and not long after felt within himself that he had been divinely healed, according to his request, of that disorder, and that it was entirely eradicated, although he had obtained even this complaint in the first flower of his youth by his devout and frequent prayers and supplications to God. For if I may be allowed to speak concisely, though in a somewhat inverted order, of his zealous piety to God, in his earliest youth, before he married his wife, he wished to establish his mind in God's commandments, for he perceived that he would not abstain from carnal desires, and because he saw that he should incur the anger of God if he did anything contrary to his will, he used often to rise at cockcrow and at the matin hours and go to pray in churches and at the relics of the saints. There he would prostrate himself, and pray that Almighty God in his mercy would strengthen his mind still more in the love of his service, converting it fully to himself by some infirmity, such as he might bear, but not such as would render him contemptible and useless in worldly affairs. Now, when he had often prayed with much devotion to this effect, after an interval of some time he incurred as a gift from God the before named disease of the piles, which he bore long and painfully for many years, even despairing of life, until he entirely got rid of it by prayer. But sad to say, though it had been removed, a worser one seized him, as I have said, at his marriage, and this incessantly tormented him night and day from the 20th to the 45th year of his life. But if ever by God's mercy he was relieved from this infirmity for a single day or night, or even for the space of 1 hour, yet the fear and dread of that terrible malady never left him, but rendered him almost useless, or so he thought, in every affair, whether human or divine. So he didn't have a very high opinion of himself either. Alfred must have been a very humble man, because he just thought that this illness really caused him these problems. So what we can see here is when he was a young man, when he was in his adolescence, he didn't like the thoughts that he was getting from all the testosterone that was going through him. He didn't like the lust that he was feeling. So he prayed to God to give him some kind of infirmity to take his mind off it. So he was given piles. And then much later on, before he gets married, he goes into the church, prostrates himself at this church to the saint, and he prays that the piles will be taken away. And the piles are taken away. And then he gets engaged, and on his marriage night, this other disease comes in, which was even worse than the piles. So it's just interesting here. It gives us an idea of how against carnal thoughts they were, against this concupiscence, against lust, and the sinful thoughts that he was feeling. He wasn't acting on them. But it was just the fact that he was having these thoughts that he didn't want to have them. And I think this gives us a real insight into the morality of the people back then. You know, they weren't promiscuous in any way whatsoever. I mean, they weren't even promiscuous in their thoughts, let alone physically promiscuous. The thoughts of fornication or sex outside of marriage, you know, that was just completely unheard of. And you can see that he had this real respect for the Christian teachings there. I mean, you wouldn't really hear somebody praying today for a disease to take their mind off of lustful thoughts, would you? So, I mean, that's always struck me as a very interesting point in his life, because you're not expecting to hear it, that somebody prays to be given piles. Truefids, any thoughts on this?
Yeah, you have to realize that kings back then, there was nothing stopping them to just take concubines and as many, you know, sleep around with as many women as they wanted, right? It's said that Charlemagne had 4 concubines, for example. And obviously, Alfred didn't want to go that way. You know, King Solomon, for example, had 300 wives, was it, off the top of my head. And it eventually caused his downfall, right? Because he started fornicating with other people's, you know, women from other races eventually. And obviously, Alfred didn't want to go that way. He wanted to strengthen his mind. And, you know, sometimes when you have an ailment or a disease, it brings you closer to God, and it does make you stronger in a way, because suffering does strengthen us, right? It makes you a stronger character in the end.
Yeah, I think Solomon was a big hero of his as well. You know, he wanted to be seen as a wise man like Solomon, but obviously he did not want to be seen as a philanderer or an adulterer like Solomon, and having all these different wives. Patriarch, any thoughts on this?
Yeah, it's a testament to his character, isn't it? I mean, who would pray for an illness in order to keep them on the straight and narrow? So, you know, it just shows he really was great. But I just want to emphasize what it means to prostrate, which is basically to, you know, to go face down before God and in a state of sort of exhaustion. So he was really troubled by it, wasn't he? And also truly humbled by it as well, which again is, you know, very, very Christian. You know, he acknowledged that he was of lowly stature. He didn't ever feel proud in his position of power. So I think, you know, all of these things you can see really just what made him great.
he took his Christianity really seriously, didn't he? I mean, it's a good point you raise up there, you know, to prostrate himself, literally lying down flat on the ground, face down in the church. And you think that's, you know, the future king that is doing that. You know, this is one of the princes. And he's getting up early in the morning so that he can do this. I mean, later on, there was a battle, and him and his brother are supposed to be taking part in this battle. And I don't know if Alfred is actually king at this time. I think it's his brother that's king. And his brother's late to the battlefield because he's still in the tent hearing mass, because they would have mass. They would hear the priest doing mass and doing all these prayers before they would then actually go into battle. And it makes a real change from originally this weak faith that the kings had, that these kings that were converted by Augustine, and when they died, their kingdoms reverted back to paganism, and they didn't really have a proper understanding of it back then. And I guess that was like 200, 300 years ago. And by the time you get to this point, they've got a proper understanding of Christianity, and they take it really, really seriously. I mean, it is a good point you raise up that he's lying down there prostrate. Well, I think we should probably leave it here. But before we finish, I'll just open it up for some final thoughts from you, Truthfids. Got anything that you'd like to finish with today?
Yeah, that battle was interesting. I believe it may have been a funeral, because I think brother too, because they were 3 and 4, right, had just died. So the funeral, Alfred's older brother was attending the funeral. So Alfred went out to fight, and then the Danes came and that ended up surrounding him, you know, in formations. And then suddenly his brother appeared, and they thought it was deliberate, that they had sprung a trap, and he ended up flanking them from behind. And that's how they ended up defeating the Danes in the army, right? But it was all just by chance and an accident. So it's just funny how it worked out, right?
Yeah, so he would have seen that as God's blessing, because, you know, his brother had been praying, and then straight after that, they end up defeating them. Yeah, it'd be interesting to look at the Danish records of these battles and the way that they tell them. I'm not sure that they, you know, whether they were literate and they were writing these things down, because remember, the Danes would come in and they would destroy the monasteries, they would burn everything, rampage through everything. Pretty much, you know, the same as the Saxons when they first arrive. But it would be interesting to know the Danish side of this. Patriarch, any final thoughts today?
Not really. Just it's been really interesting to learn about what helped to shape him, to shape this great man. I think that's really important. And I think there's lessons learned there, either things that we should kind of emulate, really. Not that we're ever going to be as great or sort of in positions of power, but, you know, we do need to admire and embrace our great ancestors, basically.
We do. We need to take inspiration from them. I mean, that's why it's important that we learn about them and we realise, you know, we're part of that same extended family, and, you know, that all these things that he was good at, that's within us. You know, we can strive to emulate him, and maybe we won't be so good as him, you know, but they're all things that we can actually do for ourselves, and we can take inspiration from him, particularly his humility. You know, something that people often forget nowadays, especially with the internet, when you have to brag about your accomplishments online. I've done this, 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 and this. And sometimes you forget to be humble. And that was really important. So that's a lesson that you can really learn from Alfred the Great here. Well, that finishes off with our introduction. We'll do some more on Alfred the Great next week. So thank you very much for coming on today, Truthfids.
Thanks, Sven. Thanks, Andy.
Thanks very much for coming on today, Patriarch.
Thanks, Sven. Thank you again for the informative podcast.
Thank you very much, listeners, for listening. We will be back next Friday with more patriotic history for you. And of course, we do hope you have a great weekend ahead of you.